All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom. Read Rothbard.
Hello, and welcome to the Actual Anarchy Podcast, the podcast where we talk about movies from a Rothbardian anarcho-capitalist perspective. Tonight is episode 186 of the show. You can find the show notes more at actualanarchy.com/186. We're doing a Father's Day episode, and we're going to have a special guest tonight. And we're doing Mrs. Doubtfire, and I don't mean that in the literal sense. We're actually going to be just talking about the movie tonight from that Rothbardian anarcho-capitalist perspective. But before we get into that and introduce our guest on the last night's portion of the show, I would like to go down to the sidelines of what was formerly known as Somalia or Vegan Suela, formerly known as the Chaz. Robert is now down on the newly branded sidelines called the Chop. How are things looking down there from your perspective from five hours away, sir?
Oh, dearie me. It's looking quite lovely, actually. It's a remarkable achievement by some anarchy LARPers that immediately went back on every seeming principle that they have. If you're anti-capitalist, if you are autonomous, do you immediately close your borders, patrol with guns, and beg for capitalist products? It seems counter to their principles, but maybe I just don't quite understand their principles, if there are such things.
Yeah, I have heard that they have many contradictory things going on, but they have achieved a new record. It's the quickest country to have run out of food within 2 days after their founding. So that is pretty impressive. One for the record books. Call Guinness, everyone. They have run out of food and they need some vegan soy hot dogs down there stat. But I do like the other contradiction of, like you'd mentioned, now they're seemingly Second Amendment supporters and closed borders people and stop and frisk seems to be cool. But now secession is on the table. And, you know, that's all I've kind of thought would be a good thing is if you can have free association and not be a part of this club that extorts you for money and imposes their rule over you, wouldn't it be nice if we could part ways? And, you know, maybe they're trailblazers in that path. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, maybe they're moving the Overton window, whether they realize it or not, by introducing this idea of secessionism into the leftist paradigm where it's, you know, usually it's bad, right? When the South did it, it's because they were horrible racists and it wasn't because they wanted to be alone or just not a part of the Union anymore. Maybe they were also horrible racists to go along with that, but still, I mean, is it okay for horrible racists to not want to hang out with you? I think it's okay. I don't know if I'd want to necessarily force horrible racists to be part of any group I'm a part of, but you know, whatever. So, yeah, hopefully they've introduced this kind of thought bomb into the leftist intersectional narrative, and maybe it's okay when Black people do it, you know, and then you can go to from that leap, right? If a group of Black people and wherever want to form their own independent nation, should they be allowed to do it? Well, okay, that's a yes. So then maybe a group of Chinese people in, downtown San Francisco, they want to stop and form their own nation. Should they be allowed to? Okay. Then can a group of like, I don't know, white people somewhere in the middle of the country, can they stop and form their own union? If so, why not?
Obviously not, Robert, but by process of elimination, we'll go Sherlock Holmes style and just deduce that as long as you allow everyone else to do it, then by default, that leaves the one group who's not allowed to do it with the same result.
Right. So, yeah, like if everybody else does do it, then by default, then you are not having done it. It has been done to you or for you. So that's cool. But you got to wonder why one group would be allowed to and one not. It's very much like when the protests were being demonized, when it was like the right wingers fighting, you know, we want to be able to fight for our jobs. And it was perfectly fine. Or no, it was very, very bad and evil and dangerous, right? Like people could get COVID. But then when it's a group of Black Lives Matter people or Antifa communists protesting against police brutality, then it's perfectly fine and nothing's wrong here. So it's, you know, it's the principle of the thing, it's the reason why you're doing it. So if a group of white people wanted to get away because, you know, they're horrible racists and they want to live by themselves and take care of autonomously themselves, that's probably bad and wrong. But if it's a group of Black people who want to get away from other people who are horrible and bad and wrong, but they're virtuous and wonderful, then they can do it. It falls under the, you know, the intersectional hierarchy of who's, you know, more virtuous than the next. I worry that that's the case, but hopefully it's the, what I said, the first thing that this idea of secessionism is not automatically evil is kind of creeping into their mind. We'll see.
Yeah. I kind of echo some of that. I know that this is an uncomfortable conversation to have, but you're bringing up some pretty good points. And I think that the response you would get from most people adhering to these ideas is that there's a differential in power. And that would be their just kind of default response. Now, what that actually means is kind of nebulous and can vary, but it's something we could flesh out at another time. Because
wouldn't you want a bunch of horrible racists to go off and live by themselves somewhere? Doesn't just seem like that would be a thing that you would want? I don't know. Go ahead, Daniel. Let's start the show.
Yeah, well, we're going to start the show. We're gonna move on to a fun kids movie instead of this heavy conversation. So we'll be right back with the Last Nighters portion of the show. Hey everyone, it's Daniel Elwood and Robert Johnson, and we are the Last Nighters. You can find us on the Launchpad Media, where they are always launching new ideas in your direction at thelaunchpadmedia.com. You can also find this show notes and more for this episode 129 of the show, talking about Mrs. Doubtfire, at lastnarrative.com/129. Now, I do want to mention that we have a Patreon, at least for now. We might not have it for much longer, but if you want to support what we do here and get some of the spicy pre-show content that we've had on this show and many others, prior episodes, go to lastnarrative.com/Patreon. And for a couple of dollars coming our way, we will give you pre-show, post-show, you and some live streaming access, as well as special offers that we've been encountering over time that save you time or money. And we get a little bit of a kickback, if you will. You know, it seems like it should be underhanded and shady, but it's a affiliate commission relationship for things that we like and use already. And so we're only recommending them because we think they might help other people as well. So hit us up on Patreon, lastnighters.com/Patreon. Show notes and more for Mrs. Doubtfire at lastnighters.com/129. And we're going to be doing some light cooking with our guest tonight. It's the culinary libertarian to discuss the lengths a father goes to see his kids amidst a divorce in Mrs. Doubtfire on this Father's Day episode for our show here. Welcome to the show, Dan Reed. You were a previous guest for Ratatouille a couple of years ago.
Yes.
Actually, you were my co-host for that one because Robert was ill.
I was your co-host for that one. And I remember I spoke much too quickly.
Well, you know, you made up for me because I speak so slowly. It drives Robert crazy, and I'm sure most of our listeners. But if you wouldn't mind, Dan, remind people what it is you do. Who are you? What do you do? Where can they find what you do? And then we'll get into this movie.
All right. Well, mostly what I do is blogging and podcasting for the Culinary Libertarian. Both things are of the same name, and they are at theculinarylibertarian.com. And up to 90 episodes of the podcast so far. If you like baking and cooking, I've got recipes for you.
All right. And just to clarify, is it theculinarylibertarian.com?
No. Okay. No article, just culinarylibertarian.com.
All right. I don't want to confuse people because thelaunchpadmedia.com is the is very important in that one.
Yep.
All
I
right.
I don't know what will happen if you put the, probably nothing. You'll get a 404.
You know what will happen if you go to conquestofbread.com or theconquestofbread.com. You'll find some Murray Rothbard articles all about anarcho-communism and why it leads to death and starvation.
Yeah, so somebody owes you some articles about that, and I know who he is, and he thinks about that frequently, so I'm told. So,
well, you know, we get to it. But speaking of getting to it, let's get down to the Google description brought to you by the Urban Carry G3. It's a holster, concealed carry, G3 just in case you need it. It's comfortable and doesn't print unless your pants are really, really tight. Then you might need to invest in bigger pants, as I discovered earlier today. But so check it out, lastnighters.com/G3. So here we go. Mrs. Doubtfire came out in 1993. It's a family comedy film starring the great Robin Williams. It's 2 hours and 5 minutes. It got 7 out of 10 on IMDb, 71% Rotten Tomatoes, 53% Metacritic. However, 93% of Google users liked it. The description reads, troubled that he has little access to his children, divorced Daniel Hillard, played by Robin Williams, hatches an elaborate plan. With help from his creative brother, Frank, he dresses as an older British woman and convinces his ex-wife, Miranda, to hire him as a nanny. Mrs. Doubtfire wins over the children and helps Daniel become a better parent. But when both Daniel and his nanny persona must meet different parties at the same restaurant, his secrets may be exposed. Came out Thanksgiving weekend of 1993. The director is Chris Columbus. Box office of $441.3 million and won an Academy Award for the best makeup and or hairstyling. And it also stars Pierce Brosnan, the old James Bond, and Sally Field. So that is the Google description. We'll go to Robert for his opening information.
I'm going to do it like this. Darth Vader, Emperor Palpatine, Sauron, Voldemort, Dracula, Jason Voorhees, Freddy Krueger, Michael Myers, Jigsaw, Hannibal Lecter. You know who these people are?
I don't know.
Amateurs. They are pretenders to the throne. These movie monsters and villains at least had some level of human emotion, humanity, some level of sympathy. In the pantheon of cinema, I would like to add in the king or the queen of villainy, Miranda Hillard, in this movie. It's not a comedy. This is a horror film. This woman creature wears the skin of a human being and yet sits next to this wonderful man, this man that all he loves doing is being a father to these great kids. And yeah, he's got a few issues. He's not the best provider, whatever. He's got some principles. He doesn't like it when you sell cigarettes to kids, so he gets fired sometimes. But this great man, she'll sit next to him in a divorce court and not even counter the judge when he's like, oh, this guy, he's terrible. He should only get to see his kid one time a week and then it's supervised and whatever. And she'll just sit there and go, yep, that's what he deserves. This woman is all those villains combined. She is the height of evil. And she's just this normal human woman in this comedy film. And it is incredible. It is incredible to watch how they tried to humanize her as like this mom character when she's doing these horrifically inhuman things to Robin Williams in this film. Daniel.
Well, that's quite the open. I didn't expect you to go that direction. And when you were leading up to that, I thought you were going to go with the judge, because the judge held all this power over the situation, almost like a godlike power about whether he could see his kids or not. And I thought that was like the face of evil when I was watching it.
Oh, definitely. He's evil for sure. And he's the state personified, and he's the actor and the boots on the ground thug in this case, who is violently separating the people. But for this lizard creature in a human skin suit to just sit there knowing that he's this incredible father, that all he wants to do, he lives and breathes his kids and to care for them and to raise them well and make sure they're enjoying life, and go, yeah, he doesn't deserve to see his kids. I'm just going to rip his kids away from him because he has a little bit of trouble. His apartment isn't as nice as mine or as nice as the house or whatever. Oh, he's got some older lady living with him. I mean, what are these complaints that she has about him? That he's, nothing, like nothing compared to like an actual father that you wouldn't want around your kids. The state, they provide zero case other than that he has a hard time. You know, he doesn't make a ton of money or whatever. Meanwhile, he's living in San Francisco, like one of the hardest places to live in the world. Anyway, a horrible person.
Quite the open. So Dan Reed, do you have a response to that? And just in general, the you're open for this in the Google description and perhaps why we're here talking about this today.
Well, we're talking about it because it's Father's Day, but I have to, and I usually expect Robert to have a different opinion than I do about the films. This was not what I expected. I understand Miranda is just trying to hold all of this together, and Robin is the one who from a rules. So we have the Miranda is the rule, and we have the judge who is the state and the ruler. So we've got these two competing issues, and Robin's just actually violating both the rules of Miranda, because she said plainly, I make the rules and you break them. And she's left to clean up the mess. Now the judge as the state making being the ruler, I think there's an argument to be made that I don't know how it would look, but a private entity could manage these kinds of affairs much better. And certainly everyone's going to agree that taking children away from a parent, this parent, was, they need to make a movie. But it's a harsher sentence than is necessary. But if they don't do it, they haven't got a film. So part of the things that are happening in the show and the movie are devices to move the movie along to get to the end. And I recognize part of that. But at the same time, there is a discussion to be had about how much power does the state deserve, somewhere between 0 and 100%, for managing family affairs.
Yeah, we did an episode not too long ago called Instant Family, a movie called Instant Family with Rachel from Canada Seals Me. And we got into a lot of these nitpicky issues with the courts and the adoption process. And it seems to have a similar situation here. I do like at least that they brought up the concept. The judge even said it early in the film that normally we decide for the women just predominantly. And maybe that's an issue. Maybe that's a problem. And I'm kind of surprised that that was like even brought up or even mentioned, because I think it is an issue and it is like a very predominant thing, and it's not viewed as an issue. I think it's just viewed as what happens normally. But to Robert, your point, yeah, this is a very loving father who dotes on these kids and really does wish the best for them and spends as much time as possible with them. But he also is a guy who is like a man child. Like, he is basically one of the kids. He's just like the lead kid of the kid gang. And I can see how as their marriage grew apart, because she was no longer wanting to have this fun man-child in her later life. So no, I can see why she was unsatisfied with the marriage. But I, to your point, yeah, she went too far in not pushing back on how much time the Robin Williams could spend with the kids. Robert, you're taking
She was absolutely quiet and silent about that. And you know it. She didn't mumble a peep in his defense at either of the trial sessions. Now, the fact that
she's not there for his defense.
Right. I understand. But
why you have an expectation that
she has a shred of humanity?
What?
Yes, I do have an expectation that she has a shred of humanity in her. Right. That she has a sense of fairness. Not that she's just like, I deserve these kids all the time and they shouldn't even see their father. What kind of inhuman monster has babies with a guy and raises them for 14 years and he's been nothing but a loving father the whole time? Even if he's got his faults and maybe their relationship isn't perfect, but he's been nothing but a loving, doting father the whole time and goes, this guy doesn't deserve this, his kids. Maybe
his
one supervised vision
was
once a week.
Her. She admitted when she was bearing her soul to Mrs. Doubtfire that in the beginning, the humor and the spontaneity was great. But as she grew in her career and in her adulthood and into parenthood, he didn't. And so
he took on the other role. She was the absolute rule maker. Yes, I understand. I agree with that. But I don't see that as him being a man child. That he took on a different tact with his parenting, for sure. He was the fun, he was the loving, the caregiver type person, and she was the more stern rule maker. That person,
that he wasn't a good father. Her complaint was that he wasn't a good husband.
Right.
And after
how does a bad husband but a great father deserve to not see his kids?
Well, your deserve is a curious word choice. I can't answer that question. I don't know about deserve, because that's not a decision that I can make for somebody else. But one of your questions was, how can this person after 14 years sit at that table in the courtroom and not say a word? And my answer is, this is a woman after 14 years of absolutely over it, doesn't want another day of the same. She's looking for something that's some kind of a resolution. So why doesn't she speak up? Because she needs to go on.
Interesting that Dan and Daniel would both choose to defend Adolf Hitler in this situation. Interesting. Okay. No, this
so
is good.
What I'm hearing is, of the three of us, you're the one without a wife and kids.
This is also true.
Oh, burn. Deep burn. Double N burn.
Well, burn. There's if you've never, whatever you haven't ever done, you can have an opinion. And Robert's got good opinions, but there is an experience base denied that opinion. So there's information that can't be had because you haven't had it.
All right. So you're saying my lack of experience affects my morality judgment.
I'm not saying it's a morality judgment. I'm saying not having kids in the house for 14 years has denied you what that feels like.
So you're defending her by saying that she's had 14 years of experience with this guy. So even though he's a great father, he doesn't deserve to see his kid. Is this your argument?
No, my argument is not that he doesn't deserve. I've already spoken that I can't speak to that part. I'm acknowledging her position. I'm not sure I'm defending it, but I'm saying
okay.
I understand it.
Okay, fair enough.
But he's also got his, as the, I'm not sure that I'm on board with being the fourth child, but I understand where Daniel's coming from with that. But he is not blameless in his behavior. He has refused on some level to acknowledge when it's appropriate to be the fun, go loving, let's go have a party and dance on the table, dad, and the stern, you need to go do your homework and you're not getting a snack and this is what has to happen. And it took inventing a personality to be the father Miranda wanted from this guy in the first place. So clearly that ability is there. And as an actor, well, so here's the point. This is the judge's point. And I can't believe I'm sort of siding with the judge, at least in the argument. I don't like the decision. But if he has the skills of an actor that he has, why did it take this? Maybe that's the answer. Why did it take this moment to find that acting skill as the solution to being the father Brand wanted?
Well, hang on now. Let me get into word edgewise between you two here. Because I am skeptical that Robin Williams' character was just Mr. Happy-Go-Lucky Fun Guy the whole time, all 14 years. And then all of a sudden he puts this makeup on and all of a sudden he's just this great father character. Yeah, we only see him at the very beginning of the film setting up this party for his kids. And then through hearsay from Bill's character, super villain, that he's always like this, that he's always been like this. But that is seriously taking the word of Voldemort over that of Harry Potter. And I don't know who you trust in this situation. Clearly you're on the side of Voldemort, which is fair enough. You can take her side, but I would just tend to trust the hero character in this film who is clearly established as a good character over the one of the greatest villains of all time.
All right. Well noted, Robert. Now, if I may, I present two arguments to kind of bring this situation together. The first one is that due to the state monopoly of justice and the judge being the arbiter of this and the adversarial process by which these situations are resolved and the aforementioned tendency for the woman to come out ahead, I think that the very nature of that process almost requires that she goes for the jugular. And so she's not going to stand up for him. She's going to go and go after the strongest position that she can. And so that by its very nature is going to be less fair, especially to the father and a good father at that. Now, the other side of it is that I think that the Robin Williams character, he is just a big kid and he has been for a long time. He never really grew up per se. He just kind of got older and they grew apart. And so Miranda became less happy in the marriage without any real comment to his fathering abilities. But he also never really developed any of the home making skills like the cooking, cleaning, sewing, and whatever. However, when he was faced with this crisis of losing access to his kids, he came up with this plan of dressing as this woman to get close to them. So that's kind of like this childish way of going about it. But in that process, he began to work on himself to acquire the skills and demonstrate his responsibility. He took initiative and he learned how to better interact with the kids, how to help develop them further, how to do those necessary things that maybe he perhaps should have picked up earlier. And though it was too late to save the marriage, he ended up being a better man by the end of this. And so I think that that's kind of the explanation for why she was not standing up for him. And also why he hadn't developed these skills previously, because he was just unaware that there was really a problem. And it was only once this crisis had built up to this boiling point to where Miranda was just done, that he finally had to confront the situation and try to come up with a solution. And they made a goofy movie out of it. Though I got to add, and my wife thought the same thing, like when we were watching this the other night, we're like, this is not how I remember watching it. Like 20 years ago, this movie seems totally different. because it is a lot heavier than my recollection. My recollection is it's right. like this kind of like family movie, kind of comedic, happy-go-lucky. But I mean, there's some dark shit in this
because it's Robin Williams and he's a funny guy. So your suggestion is that incentives matter prior to the courtroom. He was not incentivized to do any of the things that plainly Rand wanted. Perhaps they were not articulated well. We don't know that. Now, because this is a movie, because it is a forced viewpoint, the things that we don't know are what are the bad parts of Daniel's character? What are the good parts? Yes, Robert, she has good parts. What are the good parts of Miranda's character? She's keeping rent on the house or paying on the house. She's providing a place for the kids to live, and she's providing food for the kids to eat. Do you
Hitler liked animals. That? He was vegetarian too, so you know he was a good guy.
Sorry, what was that?
Hitler was a vegetarian, and he liked animals, so I'm sure he was a good guy.
Drank water too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Literally. No, but I think
you find no redeeming traits of Miranda, even in doing the basics.
There is no excuse.
Tending to the children.
You think she was doing what was best for the children when she said that she?
I said basics. Even I'm finding the lowest common, the lowest possible place that you can say she was doing something good by keeping the kids off the street and keeping them fed.
She wasn't up to that point. But I think Robert's point is like once she decided to dissolve the marriage, then she went for the jugular and went and just trashed Robin Williams.
Okay. Well, if Robert, is that your point?
I think that once she decided to end the marriage, yeah, she went full scorched earth and decided that he had no place in their lives. And that is absolutely unconscionable. The fact that this great man, who obviously loves his kids so much, lives and breathes these kids, would be expelled from their lives forcefully when she has all the power in the world to change that at any time. Knowing their relationship, knowing that the kids love him. Knowing that he's an important part in their lives and their development, and to remove him from that equation, that is an unconscionable.
And if that's your position, then that's a position I can say I agree with you. I concur with that position.
Okay.
I mean,
she wasn't murdering everybody in the movie.
That's a good thing.
She wasn't outside at like a park.
She wasn't outside at a park during a pandemic. It's true.
Taking down statues.
So she's, you know, technically human, but.
You know,
no, I think she's an absolute horror villain in this movie.
Do you think the progression of the movie? So Daniel, Robin Williams' character, finds skills and abilities he's lacking through this persona of Mrs. Doubtfire. Do you think also that Miranda finds some humanity in herself by the end of the movie?
There is a confrontation at the end after she sees him on television. And sees that, you know, they watch the show every day and they love him and they think he's hilarious and whatever. She finally ponies up the courage to, you know, confront him and say that she's made a mistake. And Robin Williams has this incredible, absolutely on point line where he's talking about how could she? She didn't say anything when the judge handed down that terrible sentence.
Right.
When she knew, she absolutely knew the facts to be otherwise, that he absolutely deserves to see his kids all the time.
Now you're talking about Robert, the second courtroom scene where he gives this very heartfelt speech. Robin Williams does about how he lives and breathes his kids. He's addicted to his kids. And
no, I'm talking about the confrontation at the end when she sees him at the movie set
after.
Right, but this is after that second court scene.
Correct.
Yes.
Where the judge is like, you know, I've seen some great actors, and that was
right.
That was
and
a
right.
great
she
speech.
She doesn't counteract that. She doesn't right. go. She doesn't go. No, that's not an act. He loves his kids.
Right.
He's absolutely that person. And the judge is like, no, I think he's just a really good actor. She didn't say shit.
Right. And
Fuck her.
What I mean in the first courtroom scene where he got just the like limited visitation, the once a week or was it twice a week, whatever it was very limited. It wasn't supervised, but I think she just went with that one because that's what the judge threw out there because he didn't have an established residence and the job or whatever. And then they were going to revisit in 90 days. And upon the revisit, then I totally agree with you. She knew materially that what he said was true and the judge didn't believe it, thought he was just being an actor. And that was her huge like faux pas. Now, are you making the Seinfeldian argument that she had a duty to correct that? Because it's not like a Good Samaritan situation where it's some stranger who needs help. this is actually like someone you're in an adversarial relationship.
She had a human obligation. Yeah.
You know,
for the best,
to be a human being, to be a basic human being.
Right. And for the best for the kids, right?
Absolutely. To be a mother.
The second courtroom scene was supposed to be 90 days and it came on 60 days. And I didn't get a satisfactory explanation of why they didn't go the full 90 days.
Because of the restaurant reveal that the father, that Daniel had been pretending to be someone else to be close to the kids.
But that's the restaurant doesn't have an issue in that. So who was the complainant? It had to have been Miranda.
Had to be Miranda.
Yeah. they make allusions to that. They're like, yeah, you did all these actions recently where you pretended to be someone else. You defrauded or whatever, you know, and you defied the court order limiting how much access you had to the kids, et cetera, mm-hmm. et cetera. Mm-hmm. And that brought up an earlier, you know, confrontation of the trial, or not trial, but whatever the court proceeding is.
So, yeah. And so,
and I'd be mad too if this ridiculous scenario of somebody dressed up as someone else and they were, you know, not supposed to be there. Yeah, I'd be a bit miffed as well.
But would you, Daniel? Would you be upset? You don't think if you were in Robin Williams' character shoes, you would be upset? You'd think it'd be totally fine?
Well, he was obviously upset as well.
Did he have cause to be upset, Daniel? Was he justified?
Probably. He wanted to like offer his services to spend time with the kids instead of her hiring the nanny. Now, what did you think of him changing the number and then like creating all these fake calls to poison the well of that looking for another nanny?
There was a couple of situations where it's not obviously an app violation, but there were a couple things that he did. Changing the name, the numbers was one of them. A few of the things that really make you could say, I understand the desperation of a father wanting to do this, but there's some sort of shady behavior there. And that's,
he is the victim of an immoral act. He is not the moral actor in this situation. He has been forced by the state against his will to not be able to see his own children, his own progeny. He is not the moral actor. I'm not saying I'm giving him carte blanche to murder people.
Oh,
these little
up until before that,
transgressions
fine.
And frauds,
you can go
I
do
have
it.
Like zero problem with.
Tanya Hardy and Nancy Kerrigan, and that's fine. But murder is out of the question.
I'm not saying that he should get physical with anybody, but I saw him as the hero character the entire time. I'm not saying the hero is a flawless person.
See, I think he's not always the hero, and
Well, you know, we were just not. We don't want to hear his argument.
That's just kidding. True.
Hopefully, he'll join us back and finish making his point. All right. Yes, I think he is back in the game. All right.
Hey.
Not the hero, but
by changing the phone number. Now, granted, he's depriving somebody of possibility of earning an income for the family. Now, granted, what we're shown is people you wouldn't want to hire no matter what, but that's not really the issue. The issue is he's forging something. Now, we don't want the block here telling us a forgery. Yeah, forgery's great. We love forgery. There's an issue here. He's causing somebody possibly some harm and not getting a job. That's not, I can't show you literally, wow, I can't even say it, that's the case. But
I'm with you on the fraud aspect, but I'm not saying I don't agree with you that someone is owed a possible job or anything like that. With like, he's not interfering with anybody's ability to get a job.
Wants to give somebody money.
She wants to give somebody money. Yes, but that's not to say that she would have hired any of those people.
True.
Well, what people are you guys even talking about? All the phone
people
calls.
That otherwise would have called.
Right, but we don't know who those people are. Than we get
I'm saying.
Short reveal at the end of like some applicants who all get crossed off the list.
Right. So I can't show actual harm to somebody, but the possibility has been established that somebody isn't getting a job because of his action.
Right, but nobody's owed a job either.
I agree with that.
All right. So speaking of this whole elaborate plan of changing the phone number and then making these phone calls, pretending to be applicants and just being like terrible applicants.
Right.
When he makes that go in for the kill call as Mrs. Doubtfire, he's got this whole elaborate plan, this whole thing figured out.
He's kind of winging it, but yeah.
Then she asks, well, what's your name? And he's like, I didn't give you the name.
Yeah, that was kind of stupid.
Who makes an elaborate plan and doesn't have a name for it? Now, this is the exact opposite of me. I come up with great names for websites, for concepts, for ideas. The rest of it, the rest of the plan,
just
doesn't, right. Yeah, that's true.
Doesn't work out. But like, how do you have this whole elaborate thing, and then you're like looking at a newspaper, fireman put out fire. Oh, Doubtfire, Mr. Doubtfire.
Dude, he's flying by the seat of his pants, man. He doesn't even get the costume and or the face thing until after he gets the job, or goes after he gets the after the phone call.
Right, right.
He goes to the interview.
And just, so, you know, conveniently, his brother-in-law, or brother, his, it's his actual brother, right?
He happened to be a Hollywood makeup artist.
Yeah, in San Francisco, for some reason.
It's convenient. You know, it's got to work for the plot.
Yeah.
Well, I think some of the things that are presented, like not having the whole costume or going through the progressions until finally, I have plaster. So I think part of that is just devices for the movie. Partly because you've got Robin Williams and you have a chance to do all of these things that someone going to a Robin Williams film is going to want to see. They're going to want to see, they're going to see his spontaneity and his, the guy he is sing, the music, the whole thing, the whole Miguel. We got to see it all.
So you got to see his Barbara Streisand.
Yeah. So I'm just, because I was curious about it, when Columbus was filming, instead of having one camera, they had like two lines set for the scenes, but he had three or four cameras rolling all the time. And then Robin would do, these are the two written scenes, and then just shoom, go. And kind of like in the Billy Crystal scene in Princess Bride, where they just let Billy Crystal go. And Rob Reiner was holding his gut so hard, he broke a rib, trying not to make noise laughing, because Billy Crystal was just bam, bam, bam. Well, you know, you get Robin Williams in front of a camera, you better be ready for a long take.
Yeah, I think they also did a similar thing with his genie character in Aladdin, where he just recorded him and then they just animated him afterwards.
After all right, you go. We're going to get a coffee. We'll be back. So, but that's, so there were a few moments when I was, when I was taken out of the movie because something was preposterous. The truck running over the mask was one of those. It's like, come on, stop it. But I recognize that this is a device to move the plot along. You've got to have some tension in place, even though it's ridiculous. I can forgive those things because I know what's going on.
Yeah. And that's a good point. I mean, they wanted to like showcase all of Robin Williams, like ad-libbing and his like impressions and singing and whatnot. But
very good.
Within the constraints of the movie, he had already established that he is some Scottish/English lady of the house or whatever, nanny. And then he dresses up as Streisand or as this Cuban woman or as, you know, whatever else. It's like, no, that doesn't fit with the story you just started telling me. You know, so if they had fit in him trying on the different outfits and the different characters before he established that call with Miranda, that he's going to be this British woman.
Yes, yes.
It would have made so much more sense.
Yeah, no, that was weird. Like you're trying to, you're going with this old British nanny voice and then you're dressing up as these other characters that aren't an old British nanny lady. Yeah, it makes no sense other than to showcase Robin Williams and his craziness.
Yeah, and all you had to do is move that ahead somehow, you know? Hmm. Like, hey, I got this wild idea. I need to be a woman. You know, I need to cross dress or whatever. Which, speaking of, there were so many instances in this film where I'm like, holy crap.
You could not make this movie today.
Yeah. How is this not shut down? How did they not go back into the Twitter feed from 1993?
This should be canceled. Yeah, I know. This movie is so transphobic. Like when he's calling her and he's like, oh, I used to be a man or whatever. And she's like, oh.
Right. Yeah. Actually, remember? Having
people like, that's another reason why she's evil. She's transphobic.
I have to admit that is, I completely ignored that possibility, but that's true. That's a whole storyline that I bought entirely because it's San Francisco. So
yeah, you should be totally used to it. And then his son is completely freaked out by his nanny having a penis. I mean, come on.
That's a fairly reasonable response from what, 12, 13, 14 year old, or maybe even older. I mean, you see.
Do you think that this movie just hasn't hit that point because it's not like a movie that people go back to? Like I had said earlier, I haven't seen this in like 20 years, and it's way different than I remember from the 20 year prior viewing, where it's like more of a kid movie. It was like cutesy or whatever. But because people don't really have a reason to go back and watch this, maybe that's why we haven't seen any recent outrage, because this generation of people has no reason to go back and watch this movie.
I mean, they're making Gone with the Wind even longer for some reason now.
I thought like, they made it gone.
It's already like five hours long or something. And you already want to shoot yourself in the face something. When you're watching that thing. And now they're like adding on a disclaimer at the beginning of it.
Something. I don't know what it is.
I thought that it was gone from HBO Max.
They're just adding a disclaimer to it. Like this is depicting slaves, ex-slaves being okay with their ex-slavery or something.
Yeah. You know, so Robin did also, was the Le Cage aux Folles, something like that, with Nathan Lane.
The Birdcage, yeah.
The Birdcage. And so there's, so at least he has more than one. So it's hard to, it's hard to get mad at him for that. But the other thing is, he killed himself. So we, there's an actor that probably was universally loved in Hollywood, who for, I was actually emotions are what they are, but I was kind of mad at him for a long time for doing that, with knowing nothing about what caused that. Just depriving me of himself made me mad.
Yeah, I remember when that happened, and Steph Molyneux came out with a video talking about how he had a bunch of previous marriages and children, and that because of that and the divorces that resulted, it's almost like he actually lived this movie in a way. No. But he was paying so much every month, and he had to keep working to try to like come up with the money that was the judgment against him. Yeah. And his work was waning, like his bankability as a star was going down. But all of the amounts he was required to pay was based on like back when he was a bankable star.
Oh man.
And so that was like all this added pressure on him.
And wasn't there also the drug issue? Like he used to take a lot of cocaine and whatever to get up for his crazy movies and whatever and be up for it all the time. And that was just like a real roller coaster for him to deal with.
Yeah, he had a big alcohol thing too. There's a documentary, I think it's on HBO. I think it's called Come Inside My Mind, which documents, you know, his rise to stardom, hanging out on the Sunset Strip with like John Belushi and that crowd. And he was actually with Belushi the night that he died. And then the different, you know, issues of alcohol and cocaine that he went through as he became a rising star and all these things. It's really quite fascinating, but he is a very quick witted guy. And he riffed a whole bunch, even in this film, they said that they made, I think four different, rating cuts of the film, G, PG, PG-13, R, and like NC-17, because some of the stuff he riffed was so like out there. and they, you know, and they had like,
I want to see those cuts, man.
I know, right? I want to see the special edition, the NC-17, you know, where Rob Williams just saying the nastiest shit.
Hell yeah. No, but, I mean, he's obviously an amazing talent and he will be missed. And I don't know if there's going to be another person like him that could replace him. I mean, he's a one of a kind.
I don't think there is. And so the point now is, so you've got, he's got these two movies and he's got an accepted irreverence for everything. So he gets a pass, and then, you know, the suicide gives him just, you can't, what kind of a pig do you have to be to criticize him now in this movie?
But yeah,
you're right. There's no way this movie gets touched today. It would have to be, everything would have to be changed. So
yeah. Coming after Robin Williams, talking shit about Robin Williams now, it really makes you look like an asshole.
Lesbian couple. She comes in as a man, and it just, that's the only way you could do it.
But yeah. They had talked about doing a sequel for a long time.
Yeah.
It was starting to come together, and then the suicide happened, and obviously that put an end to it. But yeah, so we've got, 10 or 15 minutes left of show time here. So are there any notes that either of you guys have or any other discussion points that we can kind of jump off of? I have one, and that was where the 5-year-old kid repeats back to Miranda what he had said, and she took everything super literally. Like, why would you want mommy to die? Because kids are very, very literal.
5-year-old's gonna do that.
Yeah. And what other, you know, choice words do you want to teach our 5-year-old? Well, I'll tell you, my almost 5 and almost 7-year-old, they say some things that might not be safe for
by 5 cars.
Other children to hear.
Other children are traditional company. But like when one of my friends was visiting recently, my 5-year-old said, yeah, we can't go anywhere because the government lied about the flu virus.
Yeah, that is what's keeping people at home.
Yeah, don't take her out.
Yeah. Now, listen, I'm not saying the flu or the COVID thing isn't a real thing. I'm just saying that it's over dramatized and made into a bigger deal than it really is. And my stance has been that the number of cases will increase and the fatality rate by, the denominator of that will make it be a much smaller death rate than we were told would be for months and then thus necessitated the totalitarian lockdowns. And so, yeah, we talked about it with the kids.
That naturally comes up, I'm sure. Why can't we go outside?
The oldest, when Mrs. Doubtfire is making them do chores, and the oldest says, this is exploitation. Oh, man. Even back then, they couldn't help themselves. And then there was also a few moments of just global wacko. And I forgot what there was some... There was something about that, but it just sort of stood out.
One thing I noticed was at the very end of the film, when they're in the restaurant, and they asked to be in the smoking or the non-smoking section.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, yeah. They used to be smoking and non-smoking sections in restaurants back when, you know, the free market was allowed to operate and there wasn't the government interference forcing everybody to be non-smoking. But back in the day, you could actually accommodate two different customers. Huh. That's kind of funny.
It never really worked. If you were ever in a restaurant, they had them both. You couldn't be far enough away from smoking to not smell.
It was, you're right. It was smoking and less smoking. It's true. But, but still, you wouldn't be able to have this contrivance at the end of this film where he has to go between the smoking and the non-smoking. So you could probably have it be just in one end of the section of the restaurant and the other. But
yeah. My five-year-old, because we rented it through whatever it was. No, she's not five, she's eight. I think I remember the first time seeing it when they were at the Bridges restaurant and he has to go between characters, go between dinner guests. I think I probably thought that was funny. This time, I was aggravated. It was so, yes, the vehicle device to move the movie along, but it's, come on. It was so stupid, I got up half a dozen times to go get chips or peanuts or fill up my water. My eight-year-old thought the whole thing was fantastic.
Well, what made me mad was the fact that there was only a men's room and a women's room. How bigoted was this restaurant owner to not have a trans man pretending to be a woman restroom? I mean, this is ridiculous.
And San Francisco, even.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
And you know what?
Behind the bigotry.
They had restrooms at all. Just go out in the street. Come on.
Or unisex. Come on. What's going on here? Unbelievable.
I did like his one line where he said, and this is probably ad-libbed, he said, honesty is a quality soon lost, especially upon entering politics.
Yeah, it was funny.
Indeed.
Mm-hmm. It probably was. And it's hard to know what the script really was because he's just, we talked about letting him go. And in the last week of the Johnny Carson show, Robin and Jonathan Winters, they just were on together and Johnny was just like, whatever. And those two just riffed back and forth and back and forth. And it's amazing to watch those two work because Jonathan Winters also had that same very, very quick mind and to go from voice to voice to voice and character to character and the two of them together. My God, go find it. It's on YouTube. It's fantastic.
Okay. Yeah. Assuming it hasn't been deplatformed, I will find that and put it on the show notes page, which will be what? lastnighters.com/129. We're also going to have links to your Culinary Libertarian website, cool. Your prior appearance for Ratatouille,
uh-huh.
And any other stuff that we've kind of stumbled across in this somewhat meandering conversation that we should start to close out how we do, Robert. Unless you guys have any final notes, Robert, you can lead us off with your final summary review and scoring system, however you want to do. And, you know, I feel bad because we've hardly talked about cooking at all.
We got to mention that scene, right? We previewed it a little bit in the pre-show, but we got to talk to Dan about, we can't have Dan on and not talk about the ridiculous cooking scene.
Well, ridiculous is right. So when that scene opened and he's got his rubber latex bra on. So I presume it was potatoes in the front, just boiling like crazy. There's a pot in the back boiling. There's a skillet with something in it that's smoking. And he's finding, and then to find a pinch of basil. Oh, shut up. Stop it. Then bloop, of course, the top comes off and all the basil goes on the thing. It's already charred. It's already trashed. Just save the money. But the thing, that's fine. You got boiling stuff, overflowing, manager heat. Boiling hollandaise, that's not a thing. Hollandaise isn't a boiled sauce. And it's like, oh, stop it. This is just too stupid. And then, of course, clothing catches on fire and all those distractions. And then how does Miranda not smell the smoke? How does the smoke go away? I've burnt stuff before. It doesn't just poof, go away. This is the cooking scene irritated me tremendously.
Yeah. Like I said in the pre-show, it was like those terrible infomercials where people are struggling to do basic tasks. Like even if you're bad at cooking, you don't just have a million things boiling out of control in front of you with everything turned on blast. It's super easy to just dial it down a little bit. I don't know.
Yeah, but
have stuff boil over still. I mean, you got to like remove
it. Not when you're sitting there watching it. I mean, when I've left the room. Oh, yeah, it's boiling now. Okay, but
yeah, and I do love those infomercials where they're like trying to hammer like. Products,
you can watch them, and that there's enzymes in dairy that you'll sit there and blah, 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 and then and no kidding, in seconds, it goes from low to over the edge. You got to be there. But that stuff is just like, yeah, I just made dinner like four different dishes, and none of that happened. But
You didn't catch your bosom on fire? You didn't catch the hot flashes your first day as a woman here?
Well, I think I'm bald. No, I did not.
And all what's right. up with the barnyard animals not being allowed in a residential area that's illegal or something in the California?
Noise ordinance. Noise ordinance, and there was something else.
Yeah, is the illegal barnyard animals or something? Some kind
of that was that seemed to be a fairly useless scene. She can be mad enough because the goat ate the begonias, and there's probably animal poop all over the place. We don't need a cop there saying this noise ordinance.
Yeah,
I think it adds to the gravity of the situation.
Now you got the cops coming to my house, Robin Williams.
Yeah. Okay. I accept that.
Yeah, but wouldn't you think the onus would be on the provider of the zoo animals or farm animals to be aware of
it's like I'm where it's permitted and where it's not? as a customer, you don't know all the ins and outs of the law.
No, but he's doing business in San Francisco. He should know that. Yeah, that's kind of stupid.
Yeah. I'm sorry, sir. I can only deliver them to a farm area or whatever.
Well, I think
it would be cool.
Still a young director then, so maybe that was the problem.
Yeah, we've got some birthdays coming up over on our side here, and seeing that like farm animal thing, we're like, oh, that's a great idea. We should do something like that.
How many dogs do you have now? You've got dogs and chickens, and what else you got? Snakes, cats,
owls, wombats.
We got it all, man. We got the one dog, two cats, nine chickens, and then there's bunnies that live under my office that we haven't seen them in a while.
There's a reason for that.
Could be.
Cook, where's my horse and feather?
You know, whenever we cook chicken now, my kids go, which one was it?
Nice. Awesome.
Did you like, no. Yeah, they all have names.
Oh, well, see, that's a problem.
But, you know, we're very careful to be like, no, it's not any of our living chickens. We have those for eggs. This is some chicken we got from the store. And they're like, well,
this one did not have a name. It didn't have a name.
They asked that. Like, did it have a name?
Oh. No, it's just chicken number 4712. It's okay.
And this is Purdue.
Yeah. So now the kids know where food comes from. Robert, if you'd like to kick us off with the old, you know, summary review.
Yeah, no, I can do my final summary and review. I appreciate the pushback that I got from this episode. Let me know. I'll let you guys know that I was not swayed at one at all by your arguments. I do appreciate that she's still a human being. But I think her activities in this comedy film are unconscionable.
Wait, you mean Shops with a Raised Fist?
Shops with a what? Oh, Shops with a Fist. Yeah, that's right. Yes, Shops with a Fist. Pocahontas herself is a monster, is one of the classic movie monster villains. Doesn't get enough props in the villain circles. I'm sure she went to 8 years of evil medical school. She's just a monster. The film itself, I mean, you can't really go too far wrong. And Chris Columbus, he made those kind of, you know, kind of standard stock Hollywood big movies back in the late 80s, 90s. You know, they're not like amazing directorial things, but he knew what he was doing and he could churn these things out. And a lot of people went and watched him. I mean, he made movies for big audiences, so you can't really fault him for that. But, yeah, I mean, you got the talents of Robin Williams, once in a lifetime talent, and the script is pretty good. I mean, you don't even really need a whole lot of a script, like we were talking about. I mean, the guy was a monster ad libber. It's a tragedy that you know, he got imposed by the state to have to pay all these ridiculous alimonies, and that ultimately probably led to him taking his life. It's just another, you know, state murder. Essentially, not necessarily direct state murder, but I'd probably label it close to something like that. The film itself, though, is a lot of fun. And I think it really we had a great conversation. I really enjoyed this. I like it when I take an extreme position and I get a little bit of pushback. So that's a lot of fun for me. So I'm going to give this like a 7. I think it holds up. It doesn't try to do anything special. There's not like special effects that go bad or whatever. There's a little bit of hokiness. But it really features a hero versus a classic movie monster. I mean, it's a good movie. I enjoyed it.
All right. And what's the score on that?
7.
A 7. All right. So, Mr. Reed, the culinary libertarian, now is your turn up to the plate, so to speak. And if you wouldn't mind, Robert went with a score of out of 10. If you wouldn't mind, like maybe Michelin stars or something more along the appropriate, well, you know, culinary angle.
So that's going to be hard. I think it holds up as a story people recognize. This is the thing that happens, something that people still experience and still go through is human drama. I think some of the restaurant scene irritated me. The dry breadfruiting, that was funny. The resolution at the end was expected and actually sort of appreciated. But looking at it now as a husband and a father, it doesn't, the entertainment value is gone from when I saw it back in the 90s when I had none. So I was thinking somewhere between 7 and 8, but since I'm asking for S for Michelin, I'll give it 2.25 stars.
All right, and just for the folks at home, rating a Michelin star is a grade of restaurant, right?
Yes.
And it's out of how many stars total?
3.
Oh, 3 is the max. Okay.
Max.
Okay. And I think that Michelin stars were featured in Ratatouille, which was your prior appearance on the show, because they lost probably, one of the stars.
Because Keller was involved in that, and they would have done that.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, thank you for indulging me on your rating system there. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
So this movie was way different than I remembered. I remembered it being this lighthearted comedy film, and we watch it again, and it's like got some dark stuff, and it's some, like to Robert's point, it's very evil stuff going on with Miranda and also with the state and the judge just being godlike and determining who can see their kids and when and how often and all of these things. And it just showcases how awful that scenario must be, especially with a father who's obviously very caring for the kids, not abusive. I know that there are bad situations that happen, and unfortunately we're stuck with the system that we have today. And so it makes sense that it would kind of sway a certain direction that it does, but it doesn't make it any like more palatable to see it, especially in this movie, a good dad get just boxed out of being able to be with his own kids, so much so that he has to take on this cross-dressing persona and present himself as something that he is not, someone he is not. Though he does grow in that process and figure out a way to, against all odds, still be able to see his kids and be with them. And it, of course, resolves fairly well at the end. In fact, the original script, I was reading that they don't have Miranda and Daniel get back together. And they didn't like that ending. So they fired the writer and had it rewritten to where it resolves at the end where they do get back together. And then they changed their mind and went back to the original where they don't get back together, which I think is the appropriate one, because that's probably more realistic or what would happen in real life. I think once sort of like you're done.
Oh, no, he's too good for her.
Yeah. And once you're kind of done in a relationship, it's real hard to go back.
Oh, yeah. You know? After someone does like something like that to you, why, what, you'd never get an erection again in that bed.
Well, there's nothing, there's the going back part. That's why we're in the courtroom in the first place. There's what was there doesn't exist. There's nothing to go back to. It's just not there. And my being the kid from a parent that got divorced, that ending's the right ending. I'm happy there's a civility. Sometimes I think that may not be true. I don't, like, for me, that was the case, but there is a difference. These two people, they need to be away, but the kids are the thing that both parents still love, and that's clearly the case in the movie. Whether, even though she's Voldemort, she does care for her kids. So there's the ending's the right ending, and it doesn't change my score, but it's at least it gives a plausible resolution to a complicated problem.
Yeah, I agree. And just my score is a black and gold for the movie, so it's still a good movie. Like, kind of a tepid movie. It's not like,
wow, that's a long time ago. Good God.
Yeah, I'm bringing it back. It's bringing it back into fashion. Now, Robert, does she redeem herself at all at the end where she changes her mind and has the judge change the order to where Daniel can now spend time with the kids, even though the marriage is dissolved?
Well, she finds a little bit of her humanity that she had lost. Yes. Does that redeem her character? I'll leave that for you to decide. I would not be associated with this person. I mean, I'm not saying that she's irredeemable, but in this film, she's absolutely the villain. If I was him, I would never want to be in any kind of intimate situation with her ever again. I mean, she would just total boner killer. I don't know what to say. She's just a
but she's total the boner killer. Nun.
She's a monster. You don't want to have sex with a T-Rex.
Well, I'm not saying that they get back together. I'm saying like the resolution at the end where he can be with the kids for, you know, X amount of time per day, but they're still divorced and they're not going to have to spend some time together. I think that was an appropriate resolution. And it was her changing right. the judge's order by going back and saying, no, he is actually redeemed or redeemable, or he's a right. good dad,
but
whatever.
What's that change in her? Her seeing him on television and seeing the kids enjoy him on television? She saw him and the kids enjoy each other all the time for 14 years. This wasn't new information for her. What caused this change in her character?
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. And to your other point, though, he realizes it's done and he does want to keep that arm's length with her. At the very end, she invites him in to wait for them or yeah. whatever. And he's like, no, I'll wait outside. Like,
no, thank you.
Yeah. She I thought that was a strong move.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
I think I don't have, Robert, an answer to your question. And I certainly don't think I have one that's going to appease you. But I think mm-hmm. there's the time of familiarity with Mrs. Doubtfire now being a character on TV, where it's not just her, it's something for everybody. It's not just her thing anymore. And that there is an appeal to this character as a consistent character, and the kids still like it. I think the time span, whatever that is, we're not told, is softens her enough to go to the judge and say, you know, we don't see that part either. We assume that that's what happened, but it had to have been. And she gets the judge to say, all right, fine, have it your way, and we'll do this.
Right. I assume that's also what happened. But I don't necessarily buy, I don't think the movie gave us enough to have her do her turn. Okay. I just didn't see it. Because yeah, she fair. Saw that, it wasn't like all of a sudden he changed and, oh, she saw him in a new light. That was not the case in this film.
That wasn't the purpose of the movie. The purpose of the movie was to give Robin Williams a chance to shine and to have this resolution at the end. And yes, she still is the bit of the monster. But that's, she didn't get the opportunity to have the arc that Daniel did.
Right. It wasn't her movie. It's true. She is the alien queen and he is Ripley with the power loader.
Yeah. I mean, it's a movie to get Robin Williams on screen for, you know, an hour and a half out of 2 hours, or maybe even more. I mean, he's in every scene.
He's in a lot.
Yeah. But overall, good movie and also a very good discussion. I do like it when Robert has a strong position and gets a little pushback. I think he likes that too.
I do.
And speaking of hot flashes, we're going to turn up the heat a little bit on this next week with Heat with Mike C. Man. He loves to do the Michael Mann movies. So we'll be doing that next week. And Dan Reed, remind everyone where they can find your work. And hopefully you can stick around for a little bit longer. We do Kathleen Turner Overdrive available for our Patreon supporters, pre-show bonus content and all that, and post-show content called Kathleen Turner Overdrive. But where can people find culinarylibertarian.com? That's the right place?
That's the right place. And on the banner, you can find all of the podcasts on the podcast page. There's a series of spice articles with some... most of them have recipes, but good information about a variety of spices, recipes, loads of recipes. So I'll pitch for myself. Anybody can make a list of ingredients. That's easy to do. The hard thing to do, where success is found or not found, is just like in that character, the procedure. So one of the things I want people to do when they cook is I want you to win. I want you to make the thing well, that you did a good job. And that comes in giving the procedure, how to make the thing. And most cookbooks don't do a good job with it. I think I bridged that gap for success, because that's really the thing that matters, is I want you to do well and eat good food.
All right. Very good. And thank you again for being our guest. You were also on for Ratatouille. We'll have that on the show notes page, lastnerds.com/129. And Robert, while I roll the Patreons down in the lower panel here on the YouTube video, why don't you remind people what they can do to support us here at this here show before we get into the Kathleen Turner Overdrive?
Well, I don't want to limit your choices, your ability to support us, but I will give you some suggestions. So you could go to the Patreon and join these other fantastic people that do support us monetarily. You can also leave likes. You can leave reviews. You can interact with us. You can subscribe in all the relevant places and things that everybody's so familiar with these days. You can also buy some merchandise at Trebser.com. It's just a link to TeePublic, but it features all of my artwork that you may or may not enjoy. But, you know, for those of you that do enjoy it, that's where you would get it. And I think that's about everything. Thank you all for listening. This has been a fun one. I really enjoyed it. I didn't know that Mrs. Doubtfire would be the movie that would set me off like this, but it was. And I really had a good time. Thank you, Dan. And Dan.
You're welcome.
Daniel's muted. You're muted, Daniel. You're talking.
Thanks for bringing the fire, everyone. We'll be back next week for Heat with Mike C. And you can find this on the Launchpad Media, where they're always launching new ideas in your direction. Check it out at thelaunchpadmedia.com. We'll see you guys all next week, and I'll say goodnight from Lesnar. All right, it wouldn't be the Actual Anarchy podcast without some technical snafu, so that's my fault there. But we're going to continue for just a few more minutes before we get into the last, or the Kathleen Turner Overdrive. That's the next portion of the show.
That's the line, Daniel.
Yeah, that's the old, I got old fooled. But anyway, I did have another question, and it's related to the genre of movies and driving culture. In the 80s, I believe it was, Dustin Hoffman took a famous turn as Tootsie, dressed as a woman. And then we have Mrs. Doubtfire with Robin Williams. And I believe that there was another person in mind to be the to star in Mrs. Doubtfire, but it was a very masculine person who was a bit of a womanizer. I don't remember the name of the person, but they said that they wanted them to do it because of the juxtaposition of their kind of persona. And then right after this, we had Tu Wong Fu, Thanks for Everything, Julie Newmar with Kurt Russell, Wesley Snipes, among others.
You're forgetting about White Chicks. Thank you.
There was
Damon Wayans, right?
Yeah, the Wayans brothers. Come on now.
Yeah, that was much later. Like
it was okay.
Yeah,
make your point, Daniel. Go ahead.
Well, I guess my point is, do you think that these types of movies, though they couldn't be made today, probably because it would be like offensive or whatever, but they pave kind of the way culturally for these things to kind of become more acceptable. And so then we see them in real life. We sort of talked about this in the past, Robert, where you have politics downstream of culture, culture kind of drives things, and then it becomes sort of like its own reality. Like it becomes a reality. Do you think that these movies were intentionally made in an effort to get us to the point where we are today? Or do you think it's just coincidental? And now these movies would in fact be viewed as offensive.
Yeah, I don't know if these are part of some grand scheme to change the culture. I mean, maybe to humanize people that dress up for whatever particular reason. I'm not on necessarily the conspiratorial angle. I'm on the angle of artists creating art that speaks to them. And then it just so happens that people like it and support it. Like I remember back in high school and college making art, and I was definitely one of those nerdy art guys. And people would look at it and completely, you know, take it off in their own head about what I intended it to be. So you could just have somebody making a movie like Tootsie or whatever, just trying to get a paycheck because that's what they think is going to sell right now or whatever. Or someone had some idea and it got inside the studio machine and, hey, we're going to try and make this movie. It's a good script and whatever. And then later on, somebody asked the question, hey, was this all part of some giant scheme to get transgender people accepted or whatever, or cross-dressing accepted or some massive cultural movement? I think they definitely have an effect because you are, in a sense, normalizing the behavior by humanizing it, right? Something you don't necessarily understand. And now you do sort of understand it, at least in this particular instance. But yeah, I mean, I'm not going to say that there isn't like a leftist bent to Hollywood. That's definitely not the case. I think if you come out with a script like this in Hollywood, it's definitely going to play better than in some anti-trans kind of a film, right? But I don't think it's like it's hard to attribute motivations to people when you just don't know, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
I think it's entirely, those are made close together because that's what was selling and successful.
So coincidental.
Well, I think first, yes. I think the first thing is, hey, look, this made money. Let's make one. So you got Dustin Hoffman doing it, which at least gives everybody an opportunity to say, hey, Dustin Hoffman did it. Let's do it too. So I think they got worse over time. They got really, really bad. And that's why they stopped, because the money stopped coming in. And that's, I think, I don't want to, Hollywood's a business. For all the other things it is, it's a business. If it's not making money, it's going to stop doing the thing because they've got a lot of bills to pay. The idea that art the whole circle, art imitates life, life imitates art. I don't know that I ever saw anybody in a Tootsie dress. I've seen so few, I can't remember people in Walmart or other places where there's clearly somebody is making a statement for himself or herself or somebody else. I don't know that that series of movies made cross-dressing accepted. If making movies about a thing makes things accepted, then why aren't more people eating brains like Hannibal Lecter? Is there some weird line between putting on a dress or eating someone's brains? Do we have to say, hey, you know what? Probably shouldn't kill people, but why not nibble on fingers? I mean, I understand the position. I just don't think it's true.
Small pushback to you, Dan, on that. I mean, I would say that Hannibal Lecter was not the hero of Silence of the Lambs, whereas Dustin Hoffman and Robin Williams were the heroes.
That's not the important part. The important part.
Well, it is, in that you're reinforcing the behavior of the hero character and kind of villainizing the behavior of the villain character, right?
I'm saying probably in all the movies where the people are cross-dressing, that the cross-dressers were the hero. So,
right, I would agree with that.
Almost a that I take that part out. We're saying this is just a behavior. So, okay, but there's a lot of people who enjoy being the bad guy because it's fun to be the bad guy because they sell Halloween costumes to Darth Vader. Lots of Darth Vader costumes still to this day, and everyone identifies with the Luke. There's an appeal to being the bad guy. Where's the line end where you're imitating the bad guy and it's appropriate, and you're imitating the bad guy and it's not appropriate?
When you are actually aggressing against somebody.
That's a good answer. But
all right, that is a good answer. And
you got something, Dan?
Well, I was going to say that we should probably actually end the actual anarchy portion of the show and get into some Kathy Turner Overdrive, so long as you guys are both satisfied with where we're at.
I'm satisfied.
Sure. Yeah. No, it's been fun.
Can I get some water?
Yes. Yes. So culinarylibertarian.com, check it out. And we'll be back next week with Mike C with Michael Mann's Heat. And thanks for joining us. This is actualanarchy.com/186 for the show notes and more. And we will see you guys in the Kathleen Turner Overdrive right after this. Maximum freedom, everyone.
Chipmunks. CHIPMUNK. We're the chipmunks. Guaranteed to brighten your day. Doot, doot. Doot, doot, doot. Doot, doot, doot.